Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
17 days into Tahrir Square and still not quite enough to get protesters what they want. Hosni Mubarak is going to stick around for a while, it seems. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering its Raise Your Rate CD as well as an online savings account and money market account. Learn more at allybank.com. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today the 10th of February. Good as always to have you with us. All day long, it was a game of will he or won't he with Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. He'll meet protesters' demands, the rumors went. He'll resign, even that he'll leave the country. In the end, he did none of those things and took his sweet time letting everybody know. A little bit before 11 p.m. Cairo time today, President Mubarak did address his country. He's transferring some powers to his hand-picked vice president, but otherwise, he said he's staying until September. We've reached Amira Ahmed. She's the business editor at Daily News Egypt in Cairo. We've called her to get a sense of how that speech is going over. Amira, welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you.
Tomorrow being a day off, Friday in the Muslim world, what happens when the sun rises in Tahrir Square? What is the mood now and what's going to be like tomorrow morning?
There are thousands of people. We don't have an exact number estimate, but there are thousands of people in Tahrir now, if not hundreds of thousands, and they were all there. The mood was very celebratory a couple of hours ago in anticipation of him possibly stepping down. That didn't happen, of course, and so now the mood has turned very angry. Now the chancellor calling again on him to leave and chanting the people want to bring down the regime, and they're calling on the army to intervene. What happens is people are going to probably be camped out in Tahrir all night, which has been happening for the past 2 weeks, but I think more people are going to stay the night tonight until tomorrow morning. And tomorrow morning, either way, there were expected to be at least 1 million or 2 million people on the streets of Cairo alone. There are already protests going on right now in Alexandria that just broke out, and more people are heading to Tahrir now to chant against, you know, the government.
When does this political crisis become real economic hardship, though, Amira?
It already has. It started when there was the curfew was put in place, and the banks were closed and the stock market was closed. Things started opening up earlier this week on Sunday at the beginning of the work week here in Egypt, with banks coming online, but the stock market was still closed. Stores started opening gradually. Businesses started opening. Factories started coming back online, but things were still very slow. Business is not as normal as it usually is. And in the past 2 days, what we've seen is a lot of people in public sector companies protesting, people in factories protesting, people in the canal, in the Suez Canal area protesting. So now it's even more broad than it was 2 weeks ago.
With those labor unions striking and with government workers now striking, how much longer do you think it will take before the Egyptian economy really and truly becomes gets shut down?
What I've been talking to investment bankers and financial analysts and then business owners and especially people in the tourism industry, which has completely died because of what's happening. And the sentiment I've been getting is people don't feel like the economy will start picking up again and that it will keep deteriorating as long as President Mubarak stays in power. And they don't feel like it's going to change until he leaves and the people start seeing real change and calls for democracy being answered. But as it is now, if this continues, people are not going home. The demonstrators and the protests are gaining ground among people who haven't been protesting from day one. It's drawing more crowds now. So this can only mean that the economy is going to slow down even more.
Obviously, things are tense and people are worried. But let me ask you this. Are you scared?
I'm not scared. Personally, no. The people in Tahrir are not scared. And I keep mentioning the people in Tahrir, but this is not where the only place that protests are happening. But this is where like the mass demonstrations are, and it's the focal point of what's going on. But there are protests all over the country. People there don't feel scared. They're finding strength in numbers. They've defeated thugs that came in to attack the peaceful protesters a week ago. And we've already lost a lot of lives, and people just feel like there's no turning back. The fear barrier has definitely been broken, and so the people are not going to back down from their demands. This is going to continue.
Amira Ahmed, she's the business editor of Daily News Egypt. We reached her in Cairo after President Mubarak spoke this evening. Amira, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Hosni Mubarak and his family have piled up quite a fortune in the 30 years that he's been running Egypt, by some estimates in the billions of dollars, certainly in the millions, the many millions. There are differences of opinion as to whether that's because of a shrewd business sense or a sense of straight-out corruption. But when strongmen and dictators depart the scene with nest eggs intact, attention turns to global anti-corruption rules and what they are really worth. The idea of how to make the global economy work better for more people, not just the rich ones with ill-gotten gains, is the whole point of our series, Economy 4.0. Here's our special correspondent, David Brancaccio.
Say you work for the CIA. Your supervisors are supposed to monitor your finances. If a pile of cash were to pour into your bank account one day, you'd have some explaining to do so the boss knows you're not up to something contrary to the national interest. What about world leaders, especially top politicians in countries with long traditions of public corruption? Turns out the world does have such a system, according to Swiss law professor Mark Piet.
It's not forbidden as a politician to have a bank account, obviously, but politicians need to be watched more carefully than other people.
Professor Piet is chairman of the anti-corruption team at the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, and one of those who tried, at least, to keep ill-gotten gains out of the hands of the family of Mobutu Sese Seko, the former dictator in the Congo. He says a multinational outfit called the Financial Action Task Force requires banks to monitor finances of these big-time politicians for unexplained surges.
This should set off red flags.
But not always. A World Bank report in 2009 called the rules for monitoring political bigwigs a, quote, overall failure, and urged more vigorous documenting of financial transactions by all politicians, both foreign and domestic. And even if a Swiss, British, or U.S. bank spotted a strangely overflowing bank account, the foreign country in question has to be willing to act. In 2003, the United Nations adopted the Convention Against Corruption, now signed by about 140 countries, including Egypt. In Cairo, Omnia Nabil Hussein is with the anti-corruption group Transparency International.
Corruption is widespread, and it's in all of the sectors, and efforts up to now are not sufficient.
As for the Mubarak family wealth, Hussein says Transparency International does not focus on individual cases, although its subsidiary in Tunisia was among groups calling for a probe into the wealth of the ousted head of state there. Still, the question arises, why wait until a government falls, Tunisia-style, before taking action?
For political reasons, law enforcement bodies in foreign states won't do it because it would unsettle diplomatic relations.
Columbia University law professor Scott Horton has worked on several efforts to seize the assets of former heads of state. He says the successor government after a change of power has both the legal authority and the police to take action.
So, you know, the dictator is deposed. The new people who come in definitely have a very strong legal hand to go after him and go after his assets.
Even some critics of the Egyptian president and his wealth point out that it's not clear Hosni Mubarak's business dealings broke the law. Egyptian law typically requires foreign ventures to give a local a piece of the action. That local could legally be a member of the Mubarak family. But these are some of the rules that may need to change if financial integrity and political stability are to come to the region. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, Cairo, no Cairo, didn't much matter. The major indices were largely unchanged. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The market news of the day has nothing much to do with the major indices. It is instead news of the stock exchanges themselves, specifically that the New York Stock Exchange is in serious talks about being bought by Germany's Deutsche Börse. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg thinks it's a fine idea. Some of his constituents we talked to outside the NYSE today agree with him. Some of them don't.
I'm all for globalization, and I feel it's totally fine with me.
It's not surprising that it's being purchased by a foreign corporation. We're giving away everything. We're giving away half the real estate in Manhattan.
I'd like to still continue to think that New York is the financial nerve center of the world.
That was Ralph Pallmeyer, Lujar Giordano, Antoine Shamley, and Lyle Hitt at the corner of Wall Street and Broad today. But the change, if it does happen to the New York Stock Exchange, would not come without a twinge of regret. Ted Weisberg is the president of Seaport Securities. He's a longtime presence on the trading floor. Teddy, good to talk to you again.
My pleasure.
Any sense of auld lang syne as this rumor of the Deutsche Börse deal moves a little farther along?
Oh, yes, absolutely. It's tugging at the heartstrings of not only my heart, 41 of going on 42 years a member of the exchange, but a lot of other of my fellow members, most of whom are all gone, retired, and off to nicer places to live. But I think their heart still lives at 11 Wall Street.
Here's the thing, though, Teddy. I mean, the New York Stock Exchange now is kind of just another company, right? It's got profits and losses, and it's got to get its way ahead in this new global economy.
Well, no, absolutely. So, I mean, on one level, it is a very emotional experience. But on the other hand, when the Stock Exchange converted from being a membership-owned company and became a publicly-owned company, it changed the dynamics completely.
You know what struck me was the pace of change of this whole thing. I mean, 5-6 years ago, you were a seat holder on the stock exchange. It was all it was doing was making those trades. Then it became a public company. Then the Euronext deal happened. And now this thing. I mean, it's been an amazing, amazing 5 years.
The change has been dramatic, quick, and severe. No question about it. The population of people that work on the trading floor has shrunk in that time period from approximately 5,000 people to less than 1,000 people. And now, of course, we don't know what this will mean going forward in terms of what the ultimate combined companies will look like. But from a stockholder's viewpoint, and we are still stockholders because when we owned our memberships, we exchanged them for stock when the company went public. You know, it's sort of exciting. I mean, who knows? Hopefully they're 8-1-1 together and it'll equal 3 or 4.
Other than the romanticism of this whole thing, does it make a difference for investors and traders? I mean, deals are still going to get done.
I think from the investors and traders' viewpoint, if anything, they will see ever-increasing benefits and speed of trading from the combination with a much, much bigger and much more robust platform.
Still a little sad, though, huh?
More than a little sad, yes. More than a little sad.
Teddy Weisberg, he's the president of Seaport Securities. We got him on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange today. Teddy, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
You can check out a timeline of the way the business of stock exchanges has changed on our website, marketplace.org. And now, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials lost 10 points today, about a 10th percent, finished at 12,229. The NASDAQ put on a point, less than a 10th percent, closed at 2790. The S&P 500 also rose a point, less than a 0.1%, ended things at 1320. Weak earnings forecasts from some tech companies are what happened. Cisco Systems deleted 14%. Akamai Technologies unplugged 15%. Disappointing day for insurers, too. Allstate unloaded 3.5%. MetLife skipped down 0.2% today. Other companies, though, had some strong reports. Goodyear Tire rolled up 14%. Whole Foods stocked an 11% gain. Dish Network beamed up nearly 6% today. That on news that AT&T might buy out the country's second biggest satellite TV provider. AT&T rang up a 1% gain. Bonds fell. Yield on the T-note rose to 3.7%. Listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation.com, helping businesses and professionals monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. Reputation Defender is now Reputation.com. By Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and Progressive.com. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll also find our new podcasts, The Midday Update, Freakonomics, and The Tech Report, all at Marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The Commerce Department releases international trade data for December. The Labor Department reports on extended mass layoffs for the fourth quarter. That's when 50 or more employees from a single company lose their jobs for at least 31 days. And she spent years as a castaway on an uncharted desert isle with no phone, no lights, no motor car. The movie star, Tina Louise, turned 77. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The American housing market is going to be front and center in the news tomorrow. We're expecting the White House to lay out some proposals for how to reform Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. On the face of it, it ought to be easy. The government does own those two companies, after all. But that's kind of the problem, because the general idea behind reform is to get the government out of the mortgage business and replace it with something, except nobody knows exactly what. So we have decided to explore what mortgage life might be like without Fannie and Freddie. For that, we've called up Peter Goodman. He's the business editor at the Huffington Post. Peter, welcome to the broadcast.
Thanks for having me on.
So we have to stipulate a couple of things, I suppose, right? One is that change will not happen instantaneously to Fannie and Freddie. And two is that nobody really wants to do any more damage to the housing market. But with those parameters in mind, what happens if Fannie and Freddie just go away?
Well, I mean, if we're imagining this fantasy scenario where there's no Fannie and Freddie, it's harder to buy a house. There are fewer people who can qualify for mortgages. Mortgage rates go up because you have much less of a subsidy from the government. And the price of houses goes down, and that hits the economy in a whole bunch of ways. The first thing that happens is a lot of people for whom the home is the ultimate asset can't borrow against it to start a business. They can't tap their equity to send a kid to school, to buy a new car, and there's less spending power in the economy.
Okay, so let's play out blue sky option number two, which has been bandied about out there a little bit this morning, that the government is not in the business of these government-sponsored enterprises like Fannie and Freddie, but they do maintain some sort of guarantor of last resort. But most mortgages come from and are backed by the private sector. What happens?
I think a lot of really bad things probably happen. I mean, you know, let's remember how we got here by having a government backstop on Fannie and Freddie, which are sort of public and sort of private. They're public when it comes time to divvy up the losses. And during boom times, when executives are cashing out huge bonuses and they're being used to enable a whole bunch of casino-style gambling on mortgages on Wall Street, you know, they're functioning like private companies. I mean, if you shift that fully to the private sector, you'll kind of get the worst of all possible worlds, I imagine, in that you won't have the support for the housing market, you won't have as much lending to lower-income people, and in the meantime, though, you'll still have the excessive gambling on Wall Street with smart investment bankers knowing fully well that if institutions get too big to fail and the losses come, the taxpayer will be there to bail them out.
Why do we have Fannie and Freddie in the first place? Why do we have government guarantees of mortgages? It's not like they have it in other countries anyplace.
Well, I mean, we have a belief in home ownership. What we have now is a perversion of a good idea, and the good idea being that when more people own things, people are more inclined to take responsibility for those things. So we all know that if somebody owns a home as opposed to renting a home, they're more inclined to think about litter, burglary, a sense of community. They're just more likely to look after the place. Unfortunately, you can build something toxic on top of that truth, and that's what we did in boosting home ownership rates artificially with too much cheap money, and now we're all paying the bill for that.
We haven't talked at all about the political part of this little exercise, which is that Democrats and Republicans in Congress and President Obama in the White House and probably whoever's in the White House after President Obama and whoever's after this Congress is going to be talking about the same thing. What's likely to happen at some point?
What's likely to happen is some incremental nod toward pulling the government back from financing home purchases. That argues for slow, deliberative. The Obama administration joins with Congress to declare victory over something incremental, and they kick the can down the road and basically hope that the economy starts growing and that fixes the housing market as more people have more money to spend.
Peter Goodman, he's the executive business editor at the Huffington Post. His book is called Past Due, The End of Easy Money and the Renewal of the American Economy. Peter, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
The Census Bureau released a report on black-owned businesses this week from 2002 to 2007. That's the data set. The number increased at a rate three times that of non-black-owned companies. In places like Atlanta, the increase was more than 90% higher. Atlanta may be a hub, but the growth happened all over the country, in particular in the North, states like New York and New Jersey and Illinois. In that vein, we're having conversations on the program this month about the African-American economic experience. Today, commentator and author Isabel Wilkerson.
My parents were born in this country, my mother in Georgia, my father in Virginia. Our roots are deep in America. But like the majority of African-Americans you might meet in the North and West, I am descended from people who had to seek a kind of political asylum within the borders of their own country. From World War I until 1970, some 6 million African-Americans fled the South with the same dreams as anyone crossing the Atlantic or the Rio Grande. They defected a caste system that made it illegal for a black person and a white person to play checkers together in Birmingham. The movement was called the Great Migration. Economics played a role. Before the Great Migration, 90% of all African Americans were living in the South. They were virtual captives, despite the Emancipation Proclamation. An oversupply of black labor held down their wages, and they had few options elsewhere. But World War I changed everything. The North was suffering a labor shortage and began recruiting black workers. The South resisted this poaching of its cheap labor by arresting blacks from railroad platforms and imposing fees of $25,000 on Northern recruiters. But the people kept leaving until the caste system built to confine black labor finally collapsed after the Civil Rights era. By the end of this Great Migration, nearly half of all black Americans were living outside the South, in the great arc of the North and West. It is virtually impossible now to extract the culture that grew out of the Great Migration from American culture. The music of Miles Davis, the literature of Toni Morrison, the plays of August Wilson might never have been written. It was the unsung decisions of their parents, like those of mine, that helped change America and left a legacy of inspiration for all of us.
Isabel Wilkerson's book on the Great Migration is called The Warmth of Other Suns. You can read an excerpt at our new book blog, marketplace.org/thebigbook. We're going to go back to the Middle East now and the regional parts of this larger story, because behind the political protests of the past few weeks are some economic realities: high unemployment, low wages, and widespread poverty. Yesterday on the broadcast, Stephen Beard told us how the wealthy in countries like Egypt and Jordan have laid claim to virtually all the power and all the opportunity. From Jordan today, Marketplace's Elisa Roth brings us the flip side of that story. What happens to the very poor?
Siham Tahar is showing me the long-handled squeegee she keeps in her kitchen. She needs it because the kitchen floods every time it rains. She and her family of seven live in this two-room concrete house in the outskirts of Zarqa, which is an industrial city about an hour north of Amman. The rain comes through the space where the corrugated metal roof and the wall don't meet. The bathroom is a hole in the floor. Here in the bedroom, she points out the crack in the ceiling. She's afraid it'll collapse on her children's heads some night. Here in Jordan, as in Egypt and many other countries in the Middle East, there's a large gap between rich and poor. Here, families living below the poverty line, like Tahar's, make up more than 13% of the population, and there's not much chance for them to escape. Hani Harani is director of the New Jordan Research Center, which is a think tank in Amman. He says there used to be more mobility in Jordan.
One day it was happening that people coming from poor areas and achieve something by better chances in Jordan. Right now, these equal chances is not existing.
He says the disadvantages start early. There's a big difference in the quality of education in public and private schools, and the curricula need to be revamped completely so that students get the kind of skills they need to work in a global economy, whether it's training on computers or learning foreign languages. As it is, the lower classes are essentially locked out of economic opportunities.
This system is enabling the elites only, and ignoring or isolating the majority of the people. In the long run, it will be a disaster for the country and for the stability.
Ahmed Hamdan directs an Islamic social center near the Tahar family's house. The center provides all kinds of services for poor people in the area: food, cash assistance, medical services, and classes like this one in religion, health, and parenting. He says the families in his community know the importance of education. And some kids even manage to graduate from high school and go on to the university. But many others end up dropping out of secondary or even primary school. And many children born into poor families grow up to be poor themselves because it's hard to break the cycle of poverty. It's nearly impossible for kids who start life in a poor family without connections to be accepted into the moneyed elite. Look at a family like Tahar's, and it's easy to see why. Her husband has been unemployed for 5 years. She can't work because of an old injury. They depend on government aid and charity to live. She says her biggest hope is that one of her daughters, who got a scholarship to the university, will rescue them. But there are days when Tahar can't scrounge the few dollars her daughter needs to get to school. And even if her daughter does manage to graduate, there's no guarantee she'll be able to find a job. In Zerka, Jordan, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Microsoft, providing comprehensive business solutions for the cloud. You can learn more at microsoft.com/cloud. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Comer Science and Education Foundation, dedicated to supporting innovative programs making a positive impact on the lives of individuals and communities. And by Putnam Investments, committed to helping families across America pursue their college savings goals, on the web at putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, the lighter side of the pending New York Stock Exchange Deutsche Börse deal. We're cribbing from Barry Ritholtz here and his blog, The Big Picture, but then again, he's cribbing from David Letterman, so all's fair, I suppose. The top 10 changes at the NYSE after the deal goes through. Here are just a couple. NYSE changes its tagline to Das Equities. Color-coded lederhosen for specialists, runners, and floor traders, because as you may or may not know, they all wear those different color jackets. And then this one, which is ours, from our managing editor George Judson at our meeting this morning. From now on, everybody, it's Wahlstrasse. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Thursday. Today, the Dow Jones lost 10 points. That's about a 10%. The NASDAQ put on 1 point, less than a 10%. The S&P 500 up as well, a point, less than a 10% there. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune into the Marketplace Morning Report tomorrow for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up tomorrow, back here, more on the economic impact of the unrest in Egypt, the start of Fashion Week in New York City, and some of the stories that didn't make the front page. Always good on a Friday. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us again tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.